You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Steelworkers District 11 and Blake and Ulig, PA. United Steelworkers District 11, representing 33,000 members in the Midwest. Protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized, we support union-made products. And Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we've got the last of our interviews of mayoral candidates. And tonight, we'll talk to Phil Glynn, who thinks the mayor's projects need to start with grassroots consensus. Then we'll talk to Cecilia Belser-Patton of Missouri Jobs with Justice about how Missouri Republican legislators are trying to undo the minimum wage initiative and the Clean Amendment that voters passed overwhelmingly last November. In the news, why does the VA have 49,000 unfilled positions? And local bargaining news from today's labor media lunch. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. Now for the news.
This is News from Our Side, March 7th, 2019. Here's some local labor news from today's Labor Media Lunch. Elise Martini of the Greater Kansas City Building and Construction Trades Council announced that the airport groundbreaking will be March 25th from 2 to 3 p.m. at the garage by Terminal A. It's a beginning. Of course, the end date has not been announced. The Machinist Union's Joe Capra spoke bitterly about the effects on the bargaining process of House Bill 1413, which gutted the rights of Missouri's public sector unions. He announced that his union, which represents Lee Summit city workers, has come to an agreement with the city after 3 years of bargaining. He said the process was much harder because of House Bill 1413, which was passed last year. For instance, now elected union representatives on the bargaining committee cannot be paid for their lost time in serving on the committee, and the union is also barred from paying them. In fact, they must lose pay or take comp time if they have it. Also, after the union and management reach an agreement, it still must go through posting on the internet, two readings, and the city council approval, with the possibility that the council can change any part of it without consulting or negotiating with the union. In other words, management negotiators are not really empowered to make a binding deal. Clearly, as several union representatives proclaimed, they are hoping the courts or the legislature throw this very anti-union law out. Tim Dupin of the Firefighters Union added that House Bill 1413 leaves firefighters and other public safety workers in limbo because it excludes them, which could be good, except that now they have no procedures for organizing with state-run representation elections. He did say on another subject that after a flurry of publicity about the firefighters' problems in negotiating a new contract for county prosecutors with Chief Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker, she agreed to federal mediation, and there's been progress in agreeing on outstanding issues.
The Green New Deal has been in the news the last couple of weeks, but little has been said about its effect on workers. In an article called "What Will Make the Green New Deal Go?", authors Frank Emspach, who used to bring us Workers Independent News, WIN, and John Ryan, a software developer and fellow in the City University of New York, say the proposed deal would require that a new green infrastructure be made in the United States. They believe its success or failure may rest on how much it focuses on manufacturing. Manufacturing is critical to producing wealth, they say, not just a stage in the evolution of human society. Together, manufacturing and infrastructure create a virtuous circle of economic growth, with the development of one reinforcing the development of the other. Long-term infrastructure outlays provide a stable market for domestic manufacturing firms, reduces investment risk, and gives firms the opportunity to develop new technologies. By researching and developing the internet, for example, the government provided a foundation for the production of trillions of dollars of equipment, goods, and services. The authors estimate that some 20 million new jobs could be created by an assortment of infrastructure building programs to create projects like an interstate renewable electricity system and an interstate high-speed rail system. Our manufacturing sector could rise from employing 9% of our workforce to 20%, the level in Germany. And the benefits would be shared among Rust Belt white, African American, and Latino communities, all who are devastated by deindustrialization. Look for the article on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page.
How many unfilled positions are there at the VA? Who's not getting health care because of it? What are they going to do about all the vets who haven't received their education benefits as they should? All of this was subject of a hearing last week in Congress where Veterans Affairs Secretary Robert Wilkie told lawmakers that there are 49,000 vacancies at VA hospitals and other VA facilities, and that filling them is not a priority of this administration. 43,000 of these vacancies are at the Veterans Health Administration. Representative Connor Lamb, a Pennsylvania Democrat, chaired. He said nurses and other healthcare professionals have major concerns about affecting of staffing shortages on their ability to provide for our veterans with the care that they deserve, as well as the health and well-being of the VA staff working longer hours to make up for the severe staffing shortages. According to the union that represents many VA workers, the American Federation of Government Employees, Wilkie isn't filling the vacancies is because this administration is willing to privatize and dismantle the VA's health care system. They say the VA has plenty of tools to complete the medical professionals, but the department has refused to offer competitive pay or address crushing workloads. In addition, the anti-union action of the federal government make works less attractive. And what about the GI Bill debacle last year, in which thousands of veterans did not receive their full education benefits because of the chronic IT issues, staffing, and budget shortfalls? Wilkie replied by saying that that started the job when that was already happening and that the new contracts went out last week. "I don't envision any new staff having to be hired," he said. "Because of the IT system, which is run by a very important big company, that will alleviate the need for additional staff." In other words, they're privatizing.
Trump told us his trade policy would create more jobs here and cut our trade deficit. This week, GM closed its Lordstown plant, preferring to make the Chevy Cruze in Mexico instead of Ohio. The new statistics on trade were released. The Washington Post reports the Commerce Department said Wednesday that despite more than 2 years of President Trump's America First policy, the United States last year posted an $891.2 billion merchandise trade deficit, the largest in the nation's 243-year history. The trade gap with China also hit a record $419 billion, underscoring the stakes for the president's bid to reach a deal with Chinese President Xi Jinping as soon as this month. The department's final 2018 trade report, which was delayed by the government shutdown, showed that the U.S. bought far more in foreign goods than it sold to customers in Europe, Asia, North America, and Africa. The goods shortfall topped the 2006 record of $838.3 billion, set as the housing bubble was peaking, and marked the third consecutive year of rising deficits. Tonight's news was read by Joyce McCauley, Chris Mann, Christina Dismang, and Jeff Milliken.
Working for the man. It's so hard to understand. Going nowhere at my job. While I work, I'm being robbed.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. For the last 2 months, the Heartland Labor Forum has been getting to know the changing list of candidates for mayor. There are 11 on that list. And tonight's talk is with Phil Glynn. He will be our seventh and last candidate to interview. So far, we've talked to Scott Wagner, Quentin Lucas, Alicia Candidate, Julie Justice, Steve Miller, and Henry Klein. We've invited Vincent Lee, Jermaine Reed, and Scott Taylor, but they have not responded. That leaves Clay Chastain, who has no organized campaign committee and doesn't appear to live here. We will be posting links to all of our interviews on the KKFI webpage following this show as a guide to help you decide who to vote for. Phil Glynn is only the third non-council member we've interviewed. This race is crowded with members of the city council. Phil is a local crossroads businessman, head of Travoy, a unique organization that advances capital for economic development by Indians. Phil grew up here, is a third generation Kansas Cityan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So this is a show about working people, and I was just looking up the stats about union membership in Kansas City, and it's actually pretty significant. There are over 100,000 people who work in Kansas City who belong to unions or are represented by unions. That's 1 in 10 workers. We have a lot of people who are both union members as well as a lot of working people here in Kansas City. So what I want to ask you is, what's your vision for them? What's your vision for a Kansas City that works for working people, where working people can live, where there are good jobs, and where we have real community? Just give us a general introduction to Phil Glynn's vision.
Great. Okay. I believe that we can only be a successful city if we have successful neighborhoods. That means neighborhoods that have high-quality housing that both our working families and our seniors can afford, and it means neighborhoods that have quality jobs, that our citizens have the skills training and the reliable transportation to thrive in. In other words, stable neighborhoods. My wife Elizabeth and I have 3 kids, so I see how stability helps children do well in school, and we all know how stability in a neighborhood helps neighbors build relationships with each other, to watch out for each other, and keep their streets safe.
What part of the city do you live in?
I live at 57th and Ward Parkway.
Okay.
Yeah. And what I've seen in my business experience is that when organized labor is active in an industry, it contributes to that stability. It contributes to safety on the job. It contributes to productivity. And that is ultimately what drives community stability. When workers have, are being paid fairly for the work that they do, then they can afford to put down roots in a neighborhood. They can be present in the neighborhood, be there long term, and be leaders in their communities, not just in the workplace. It's something that's important to me in my business. We try to walk the walk. We pay all of our people a minimum of $15 an hour. We have seen our business grow because we pay living wages. If we focus on living wages as a city, I believe our city will grow. It's important to me as a political activist. Our business was a leader on supporting the fight for 15. I was really proud to be recognized by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 2017 for that work. Went out and knocked on doors for the No on Prop A campaign. We have been very supportive of Raise Up Missouri, and we want to see this community continue to move in a direction of heavily investing in people. That's based on workers' rights, and obviously unions have a very important role to play in that.
Well, that's great. How does your business do better because you're paying $15?
We find that when we increase pay and benefits, we increase retention. We're in a super competitive labor market right now. From a business perspective, I can tell you that there's something very weird going on out there. Region-wide, unemployment looks pretty good. It's only about 3.5%. When you start going neighborhood by neighborhood, that's where you see the disparities jump. And primarily on our east side in Kansas City, if you put together the population of people that is either unemployed or not in the labor force, you combine them, that number starts to go to 20, 30, and in some rare but extreme cases, that's over 50%. Mm-hmm. What that tells me is there is a gap between the skills that employers demand and the skills training our workers have received. And for those workers who do have the skills, often transportation is a barrier. Our public transportation system in Kansas City only reaches 18% of the jobs. So what that means is we're left in a situation where the labor market is extremely tight and workers are chasing a dollar, as they should. Anytime they can see an increase in pay, an increase in benefits, an increase in quality of work life, they are choosing to take their labor elsewhere. And what's important to us at Travoy is we love the people we have at our company. Our company is successful because of our employees. And the longer they can stay with our organization, the better for us. And we also just believe that, you know, when you're at work, if you're worried about how you're going to pay your bills or how you're going to care for an ailing relative, you're not going to be really focused on doing the best you can for the company. But if we can pay our workers fairly, invest in our people so that they have a stable economic situation outside the workplace, that when they're at the office, they're all business.
Tell us a little bit about Travoy. And it's your business, right? You're the CEO?
I'm the president.
You're the president.
My wife is the CEO.
Okay.
We own it together.
It's a family deal.
It's a family deal, yeah.
So tell us how your experience there connects to becoming mayor.
We're a private business, for-profit, with a social mission of bringing access to capital and housing to American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian communities. We've brought $1.4 billion worth of investment to the communities we serve since 1995. That's resulted in over 5,000 homes that are affordable to working families and seniors, and over 5,000 jobs that are of high quality and that are accessible to people who live in what are primarily heavily economically distressed communities. We've done things like affordable housing, infrastructure, childcare, grocery stores in food deserts. These are exactly the kind of investments that we need more of in Kansas City. And I haven't just been talking about it from a political perspective. I've been getting it done from a business perspective.
Well, and these communities you service are all over the U.S.?
Yes. When you work with tribes, primarily your work ends up being in the western United States, just based on where people live. But we have clients from Maine to Alaska, from Hawaii to New Mexico, and everywhere in between.
So you go and you find people who want to partner with you, is that it, in those communities?
Here's how a typical project works for us. Let's imagine that you are the, let's say that you're the executive director of the hospital at the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma. Your elected leadership might say to you, we want you to do a $15 million addition to the hospital to make it easier, to expand access to pediatric care and to behavioral health. Go find the money, make it happen. What you would then do is you could pick up the phone and call Travoy and say, hey, I've got my hands full doing my job, providing excellent care to my patients and managing all of my employees. I want you to go out and put together a package of capital, raise the capital to help me build this project.
Oh, okay, so are these investors people who want a return?
Yes. So we go out and find investors. And what we're looking for are not just the typical investors who only want a financial return. We're looking for investors who want a social return. They want to see that they're having a positive impact on the community. And then we also make use of federal tax credits so that our investors can get their return on investment in the form of tax benefits, not necessarily by getting all of their money back, which means that that creates a cushion. That creates savings, and we can pass those savings on to our clients, which are tribal health, housing, and infrastructure organizations, because we know that they're working with very low-income people who are struggling to get by month to month. So anything that they can do to decrease their cost of capital is something they can also do to lower the prices of things they're selling to their customers, which ultimately makes it easier to get by as a low- and moderate-income person out there in Indian country trying to get by every day.
How does that translate into what you could do as mayor? How does that experience fit the problems that exist in Kansas City?
The research is showing us that we need to build 5,000 new units of affordable housing in Kansas City to end this crisis that we're living through right now. We've built 5,000 units of affordable housing nationwide. We know that we have to invest in our people to close this gap between the skills our workers have and the skills our employers demand. That's something I've done in my own business, and it's also something that I've done for the businesses in which our company invests, in which we require that those businesses create jobs that pay a living wage. We emphasize businesses that agree to hire people from the local community and to invest in their worker skill development on an ongoing basis. I believe that my skills are the right fit for this moment in Kansas City because we've had plans, we've had studies, we've had talk. What we have lacked is concrete action. And the experience that I've had in the private sector is of bringing that concrete action.
So what kind of housing would you want to build?
It's going to look different in every neighborhood. Our model, as you might imagine, you know, being someone who is not Native American but works for tribes, you know, when you think about all the history and you think about all the baggage a guy like me would walk in the door with, there's often a lot of hesitation. There's a lot of skepticism about why I'm there.
And they've been burned a bunch of times.
Absolutely. For very good reason, there's skepticism. And so here's how we overcome that. We never come in from the outside and say, here's what we think your community needs. We never come in from the outside and say, here's what you should build. We come from the outside. We identify who we believe the leader is in the community, and we listen. We support that person as they rally their community members around a vision. And once the community is united behind what that vision is, then we bring the capital in to make it happen. That's how we need to do development in Kansas City. The way it's been done in the past is that people at City Hall or people at the large employers in town, the power brokers, they decide what neighborhoods should have.
The developers.
And that's right. And then they hand these plans down to neighborhoods, and then everyone's amazed when they don't work. Well, the reason that they don't work is they don't come organically from the community. If you want to look for success stories in Kansas City in housing and community development, they're always things that begin, they come organically from the neighborhood. The people who are living closest to the issue, whether it's a lack of affordable housing, a lack of quality jobs, substandard infrastructure, they know best what to do about it. So the model of investment from Travois is that we listen to the community leads, and we provide the money to support them as they accomplish their vision. That's what we need in Kansas City, and we haven't done it that way, which is why we're not moving the needle on poverty, unemployment.
And we've been talking to Phil Glynn, candidate for mayor. Okay, so let's talk about the kinds of incentives that exist now. There's a lot of controversy. You know, there's some people who want to abolish them altogether. There's some people who say they're in the wrong places. There's some people who simply want to appease the developers. Where do you stand on this? Do we have the right tools? Do we need different tools?
I spent 4 years on the TIF Commission, and we did some things I was proud of, like a new grocery store at 39th and Prospect, exactly the kind of thing the TIF program should be used for. Mm-hmm. But there were deals that came before that commission that I just couldn't support.
Like Briarcliff Manor or something like that?
Projects that were for corporations that were already doing well in parts of Kansas City that were already doing well. And I didn't support those because I believe they took money away from our schools and libraries and handed them to private interests that didn't need them. I opposed those projects when I felt like it was the right thing to do. I pushed back against the status quo. It ended up costing me my seat on the commission. I was removed from the commission by the mayor who appointed me. But you know what? That's okay, because getting into a position in this town, whether it's elected or appointed, should never be about just getting into that position and holding on to it. We've got some major changes coming in this community, in our climate, in our economy, in our society. And I just think the only way that we're going to get through that and come out stronger on the other side is if all of us are serious about standing up for what we believe and saying what we think.
So what are those major changes aside from the housing issues?
When it comes to economic incentives, I believe that we should be more strategic about where we use them, that we should work together as the next mayor and council to use data to inform us about where incentives are needed. Because right now, they just get used everywhere. And projects just get rubber stamped and they get run through the process. The reason that there is so much anger and so much angst out there in the community about how incentives are used is that citizens don't see a clear strategy. The citizens don't feel that their voice is being heard at City Hall, and they don't feel that their voice is being heard at the EDC. And they're right. This election is an opportunity for the people to vote specifically for a change and for a candidate that wants to be strategic about where we use economic incentives, and that's me. So let's just assume for a second that there was no city council and I could just wave a magic wand and do it the way I wanted to do it. Here's what I would say. Pick a number and say, we will only use economic incentive programs in census tracts that are at or below a certain percentage of the area median income. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's 80%, maybe it's 60%, but something. Put it on paper, put it on a map, and make it clear. Because ultimately, the developers in Kansas City, sure, I know that subsidy helps projects, but I think certainty is more important than subsidy to these developers. They're in the business of making deals happen. And if they just know and they're getting clear signals about how to invest, I mean, we got some of the most creative, most successful, hardest working people in this business in Kansas City. The reason it's hard for them to do their jobs right now is the city gives them no clear signals about where they can use incentives and where they can't. Because sometimes the attitude is, hey, do whatever you want, wherever you want. And then sometimes the reaction from the community is, these incentive programs have been abused, so we're going to just crack down on all of them. We need to be real about where blight actually exists in Kansas City.
Oh, it's not in the plaza?
It's not on the plaza. And we need to use data to inform that. So what I want to do is work with the next council and say, these are the communities where we're going to use incentives. We're going to put them on a map. We're going to put it out to the development community so they can make plans. And we're going to say, if you're doing a development project in one of these truly economically distressed communities, we are going to be there with financial assistance to help you make it happen. And I will go and argue to the school district and the libraries that real community-based economic development that provides quality jobs in economically struggling communities helps those organizations accomplish their vision. And you know what? If I can't get them on board, then that means we probably shouldn't be doing it. And for developers that are going to be doing projects outside of those economically distressed areas, like parts of the Northland, like the plaza, what I want to say to them is, great, we're excited. We want to help you. And there are things that we can do to cut bureaucracy and red tape at City Hall to get you through the process faster, because time is money too. So with projects that are in the truly economically distressed communities, those do need financial assistance to pencil out and happen. Projects that are happening in communities that are already doing well for companies that are already doing well, well, sometimes all we need to do to help make those happen is make the process easier at City Hall.
Okay, let me switch gears. There's a proposal on the ballot for a sales tax for early childhood education. Where do you stand on that? Right now, our teachers union is opposed to it because it's going to give money to private schools, religious schools, and because sales taxes is not a progressive tax. Where are you at?
I'll be voting no.
Really? And why?
I'll be voting no because this plan does not have the support of our educators. I'll be voting no because I do believe this would add to the already significant cost burden that our working families are paying. But we also have to recognize that we need to build a comprehensive system of pre-K in our community. This is not the right way to do it. But the ultimate destination is somewhere we need to get to. So I'll be working in a collaborative way with our superintendents and with our educators as mayor of Kansas City to work toward a system of comprehensive pre-K that they can fully support.
I want to ask you some questions about unions that represent city workers, and particularly about the pension crisis with the firefighters. Do you have any positions or thoughts on those?
And like I said before, my experience in the private sector is that organized labor is a partner, that it helps us do better as businesses. I believe that organized labor is also a partner in providing the services that city government provides. So I'm looking forward to working with, collaborating, listening to the organized labor leaders that are, especially those who are working in public safety, because they've been around a long time. They know how the city works too. And again, just like in my business, we need as a city to remember that investments in people are the most important thing. Finding and keeping the best people is the number one thing any organization should be focused on. And ensuring pay, benefits, and retirement security is a great way to do that.
You know, we're about to build a new airport. And, you know, there's been a lot of controversy about who gets hired, not just who the contractors are, but who the workers are going to be and whether the jobs are going to be opened up to Kansas City residents who really need the training and need the jobs. I think they've worked that out. It was very difficult. But there's a whole other issue, which is, you know, like the city can have certain performance requirements. For instance, are those jobs at the airport going to be unionized? Are they going to pay a decent wage? What's the city's position going to be if the workers try to unionize? Are they going to be neutral about it? Shouldn't we put that in the agreement too?
As mayor, I'll work with the council and work with our city staff to make sure we are always following the spirit and the letter of the law. When workers decide to organize, that's a worker-led movement, and those workers are likely to be my constituents. It's my job to help sure that my constituents can be successful in the workplace. So I'll be there to support.
Okay. Do you fear preemption from the state legislature? You know, they've preempted us on the minimum wage. There's a number of things evidently we can't do that have to do with workers in particular. How are you going to work around the fact that we have a legislature that is not particularly friendly to Kansas City?
I don't fear it because I know it's going to happen. the only things that really scare me in my life are the areas where there's uncertainty. And unfortunately, we have certainty that rural state legislators around Missouri who are not from Kansas City, don't do business in Kansas City, don't have connections in Kansas City, want to tell us the best way to represent our citizens. The story I will be telling in Jeff City is this. We are the economic engine of the state of Missouri. Our people put us in office to make decisions that grow our economy. And as the economy of Kansas City grows, the economy of Missouri goes. We need you to listen to us, recognize the expertise that we have, and work together. Because when Kansas City invests in its people, and when Kansas City takes actions that make our economy stronger or greener or make our streets safer, that will grow the economy of Missouri. So when state legislators who are not from our own community try to limit our ambitions, what they're really doing is limiting the growth of the state. There's going to need to be an education process there. My leadership style is collaborative, not combative. And the people who live, who are not from Kansas City, but who are passing laws on this issue, I need to respect the backgrounds that they come from, and they have been elected too. You know what? Being a state senator, being a state rep, that's a big deal. And you've probably done something in your life or your career that's given you the standing to get that position. So let's have a conversation as friends and peers, and I will listen to you. But I have not heard one single good argument about why we should not be allowed to make sane gun laws in our own communities or to set a livable wage in our own community. And I'm looking forward to working with the delegation we sent to Jefferson City from both parties. I have very good relationships with many of the people who are in who state representative or state senate seats, very good relationships with many of the people who are thinking about running. And I'm really looking forward to working with all of those people, because if we had a truly unified Kansas City delegation down there in Jeff City, we could get so much done.
People say that the front runners in this race are Jolie Justice and Steve Miller. They have the most money. How are you on the money front, and how much does that make much difference?
We're doing well on fundraising. I've received hundreds of contributions from people all across Kansas City, some as low as $10, some all the way up to the maximum contribution. In terms of the money race, we're right in the middle. Here's what I'm hearing at the doors. I knock on doors all over Kansas City. I make phone calls. I contact voters directly. Nobody knows who they're voting for yet.
Yeah.
I don't care what the polls show. I don't care what the money race shows. This thing is absolutely wide open. We got a month to go. And earlier on in this race, when it was all about who had the most money, who had the most endorsements, sure, I think that mattered. But now there's only one thing that matters. That's who gets the most votes. And we are out there talking to people who we know are going to vote. And what we're hearing is that their vision for Kansas City fits exactly with the platform that I'm running on. So I think we're going to do a great job of communicating with our voters, getting to the polls, and I think we're going to win this thing. Neighborhood saying, your neighborhood is important to me, your vote is important to me.
Okie doke. Well, thank you so much, Phil Glenn.
Thank you.
Play KKFI. That's all you have to tell your smart speaker to get the news, views, and music you love. KKFI can be wherever you are.
Not sure who to vote for in the Kansas City mayoral primary? Perhaps KKFI could help clear things up. Tune in to our live mayoral forum, Saturday, 3 to 5 p.m.
KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience to reflect the diversity of the local and world community, and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues, and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, are underrepresented by other media. Interested in volunteering? Contact 816-994-7864 or go online at kkfi.org and click the volunteer tab. Thank you for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family, more than a paycheck, to our loved ones and family.
And that was Sweet Honey in the Rock, More Than a Paycheck. And I'm Judy Ansel, and with me in the studio is Cecilia Belser-Patton. Welcome to the show, Cecilia.
Thanks, Judy. Thanks for having me.
Cecilia is the champions organizer for Missouri Jobs with Justice, and we're going to talk about the efforts by members of the state legislature to erode and undermine the initiatives that were passed last November, overwhelmingly by the people.
Overwhelmingly.
Yeah. so we're talking about two initiatives. RUM, Raise Up Missouri, which raised the minimum wage.
Yes.
And CLEAN, which aimed at getting corruption out of our political system.
Yes.
Before we go into them, though, tell us how much work it was to get these things passed.
A lot of work. So I started working with Missouri Jobs with Justice last spring, but prior to that, local organizations had been canvassing, door knocking, getting signatures, even to get both of these bills onto the ballot through the ballot initiative process here in Missouri. People had been gathering signatures. There had been legislative work and canvassing work around raising up the minimum wage since 2012. There had been issues where primarily city dwellers, so St. Louis and Kansas City, passed for their cities to raise up the minimum wage. And each and every time that Missourians, working Missourians, declare for themselves ways in which they can empower themselves with a livable wage, because certainly we don't think our current minimum wage is a livable wage, that every time our state legislators feel like that they know better than us. It's very paternalistic, it's very patriarchal, it's very much I know better than you. And even when over 67% of Missourians voters say this is what we need for ourselves and this is what we want for ourselves. So that took a lot. For CLEAN as well. CLEAN is a bill that was helped to be crafted by the Brennan Institute for Justice out of D.C. and New York. Folks had been researching around that for 4 years prior to anything that was on legislation in 2018. People knocked on doors again for 2 years and got the will of the people of what we felt was needed. And a big thing that came out of that was getting dirty money out of politics, getting overdue lobbyist influence out of politics, making a space that is more transparent and honest for politicians so that our politicians, our legislators, can actually do the will of their constituents as opposed to the will of the lobbyist.
So Missouri Jobs with Justice wasn't the only organization pushing it.
No.
There were a lot of allied organizations.
So Heartland Alliance for Progress, HAP, as people have known it, Planned Parenthood, Fight for 15, Poor People's Campaign, just so many, NAACP.
And then organizations and in then St. Louis,
organizations in
all
St.
Over.
Louis, Organization for Black Struggle out of St. Louis, as well as the different labor union organizations were very much allied and in partnership with us
and
on this.
And many faith-based organizations.
And many faith-based Missouri Faith Voices, which is have organizers in Kansas City, Mid-Missouri, Jeff City, and Springfield, but primarily is based out of Jeff City. We had people from all over, Deaconess organization out of St. Louis. I'm just trying to
Yeah, any
keep
idea
coming.
How many people actually carried petitions or worked on the campaign?
Oh, Judy, you know this better than I do. Wasn't it something like...
I don't remember the numbers, but it was hundreds of people.
It was hundreds of people, and it was thousands of signatures.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important that
yes.
people understand that this was truly a grassroots effort.
Absolutely.
And this was supported by an overwhelming majority.
Absolutely.
And now, what's the legislature doing? Let's take the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. First, all right. So it's supposed to raise the minimum wage to $12 by 2023.
Yes, it's okay. Incremental. And I think that that's very important for people to know as well. Because what folks who are against raising the minimum wage, which are people that have probably never worked for a minimum wage, what they're trying to do is tell people that this is going to wreck our economy, that Missouri will never be able to recover from that. We don't have enough money. And that this is something that is really helping out welfare mothers in St. Louis and Kansas City, when that is not the case. It is an incremental increase of the minimum wage from now. We have already seen the first increment going to $8.05 an hour through 2023. So nothing will ever happen all at once. But what they're trying to do basically is say that we don't need that. They're trying to say that fast food workers don't need that. So one of the ways in which they're targeting that is trying to make it seem as if the folks who still work in the fast food industry are teenagers only, and that they don't need that
which
type of
money.
Which
we know isn't true at
which
all.
Isn't true. We know that the average age of a fast food worker is 36 years old, and that they have 2.8 children, so three children. We know that our current, even now, as we've raised some in January to $8.05 an hour, is still not a livable wage for adult men and women who need to take care of their families. And so there's a particular way in which they have been the enemies of raising up the minimum wage, have been really marketing and trying to target certain populations, I would say more rural populations, folks who they think don't know and don't care to know and will just listen to them around this legislation. And so one of the things that they're doing is trying to put a cap on youth. They're trying to do a youth wage exemption, saying if you are under 18, you're 18 or under, that you can only make this, that they don't have to increase it. They're also doing different things for private school workers, so people that work for Catholic schools or private schools, that they don't have to increase them to the minimum wage because they get
their own special lower minimum wage?
Yes, they do. So it's very targeted ways of things that they're doing to Missouri's working people.
Okay. So are there particular bills that have been introduced in the legislature?
Yes. So SB 10, this bill is specific around the youth wage exemption.
Mm-hmm.
So it is really targeting smaller populations. It's also targeting the cities where we tend to have many youth workers, saying that their rate will remain what it is now. We also have HB 763. This is the exemption for private school personnel.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to do some different things as well with government officials that they were unable to do because of what we asked for when we were signing, doing our signature gathering, and when we were crafting the bill. And so these, though, two in specific, SB 10 and HB 763, are ones that we really need to look out for. We are asking people to call and write their legislators. We are asking people to engage in in-district meetings with their legislators. You know, I don't think people realize how easy it is to call and say, I want to talk with you. We have that kind of access and we have that kind of power. If a person doesn't feel comfortable doing it themselves, they can reach out to organizations like HAP, organizations like Missouri Jobs with Justice, organizations like the NAACP that will assist them in that process.
Are there particular members of the legislature who are being targeted?
More so, these bills are coming out of our Republican constituency. So we do have people. We're targeting Pierpoint out of the Lee Summit Blue Springs area in our metropolitan area. I'm not quite sure of the people that are being targeted in St. Louis, but I can share that information out with you so that you can let listeners know.
Well,
Kansas City is most important. So Pierpoint, we have people that are championing for us as well. And so that is what we're trying to do, is to remind our folks that we voted in where they stood when they were wanting our votes, so that they mm-hmm. stand in that same way when they're in Jeff City.
Okay, this is Sierpont, right?
Yes.
Sierpont.
Yes.
Yeah. Wasn't Stacy one of the people who was being targeted,
yes,
too?
Yes, thank you for that,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, Blue Springs, I think.
Yes, he's
yeah.
out of Blue Springs. Sierpont is more Lee Summit, Blue Summit. Springs.
And then there
district.
Was, I think there was one up in Platte County.
I don't think so.
No? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, well, you know, I think the thing is people should ask their legislators,
yes,
where they stand.
Where they stand.
On SB 10 and House HB 763.
Yes.
Okay, let's go on to CLEAN.
Sure.
Because I don't want to run out of time and not
absolutely.
Do that. How are they trying to change CLEAN? I know they already passed something, right, having to do with
their
emails?
They did. So in case for people that don't know, CLEAN was a bill that is now an amendment. It's Amendment 1, which is very important for people to know because it is firmly rooted in our Missouri Constitution. And that was one of the targets of really trying to get that bill passed so that we would have some type of a framework and a groundwork.
And so the legislature couldn't undo it.
So that they can't undo it.
But they're still
trying. They're still trying to undo it. And those, you know, those little rascals, that's what they do. So what is happening with CLEAN is CLEAN, for the listeners, is an amendment that really has tried to root out dirty money out of politics. It has tried to root out overdue influence from the lobbyists. It's tried to root out overdue lack of transparency and honesty with our legislators to ensure that our legislators work for us and not for lobbyists. And so one of the things that it has done is it has put in a time limit of legislators that they have, it has to be a 2-year limit before they can go and work for the lobbyists. Because what we found is that many of our legislators transitioned straight into being lobbyists. And so because they wanted those jobs, they did what lobbyists asked them to do. And more importantly, one of the things that has happened in the bill is there is a redistricting and a gerrymandering aspect of the bill that really focuses on our communities that have been marginalized historically in the past. So communities of color here in Kansas City, and in St. Louis, that have been locked out of power in many ways. And so what Amendment 1 does is it says we will put those needs first. We will put those needs first, and we will make sure that we do things to really keep districts that have been underrepresented. We will look at ways to more democratically redistrict when redistricting happens. It's also a bipartisan aspect that whoever chooses the redistricting agent will come out of the current legislature. It will not be someone that a Republican or a Democrat can put in. That person will be bipartisan. They will know the history of the districts in our state and not do any undue influence. Interestingly enough, the folks who are trying to really dismantle Amendment 1, they're not concerned with the lobbyists necessarily, which was very interesting to me. What they are concerned about is the gerrymandering and the redistricting.
Right, because they're going to lose their seats.
They're going to lose
right?
their power, and they're going to lose their
and,
seats.
And this is both Democrats and Republicans.
Yes, yes. Right. And so what is happening is there's been a kind of an onslaught and a disorganizing and a very intentional aspect of marketing to different folks. The marketing that they send to folks in rural areas is very different from the marketing that they send to people in urban areas. Mm-hmm. And it is a disorganizing, kind of confusing way of getting people to not understand what's going on so that they have to rely upon unethical politicians to tell them what to do.
And there's several bills which would what? Put changes on the ballot?
Yes. There's several bills that will put changes on the ballot coming in 2020 that are saying they know that they can't fully change Amendment 1, but they can say we want these other things looked at and other people do as well, and so we're going to gather signatures to put that on through ballot initiative. Those are SSSB 213. And it's so many that this is what is really making people quite fearful about whether Amendment 1 will stay in its current form. HJR 46, HJR 47, and HJR 57. And all of those pieces of legislation are really, they're actually doing some things that are interesting. They're adding more time limits to the lobbyist component, saying, hey, we'll give you this. We'll say it's 4 years. But what they don't want is what they don't want to lose is control of the redistricting.
Right.
They're holding onto that very, very tightly.
So, okay. So what are you doing and what are the organizations doing in order to combat this?
So we're working together. We're very actively across the state. And so we have those of us who are working in the field and really in how we can really get this information out to our folks are in great collaboration with one another so that we can make sure that this is happening all over the state. We're hosting in-district legislative meetings, really having conversation with our legislators saying, remember, we're the ones that put you there here, and this is what we want to do. We're also doing phone banks. We're doing in-district canvases across the city. We're doing letter writing campaigns. We are gathering stories from our workers who this kind of thing affects most drastically. We're doing all the things that we need to do to really keep ourselves engaged and active. Normally, this is the time in legislative moments when people just kind of sit back because it's not an election year, and this is a different kind of year that we know we have to really be busy and get to work. We're going down to Jeff City, and we are knocking on our legislators' doors. We are letting them know that 67% of Missourians said this is what they want, and that you do not have the power to overturn it because you feel like you know better than we know.
Okay, before we run out of time, if people want to get involved,
yes,
is there a phone number they can call to volunteer?
Yes, they can. That number is 816-753-0609. That is the office number to Missouri Jobs with Justice. We will connect you with us. We will also connect you with other organizations that are partnering with us, that are doing different things with the phone banks. We have a phone bank that's happening twice a week, every week throughout the legislative season. We have canvassings that are happening every Saturday as well as Wednesdays. And we also have our letter writing campaign. So please call 753-0689. Ask for Cecilia Belzer Patton, ask for Paul, or ask for Jordan or Justin. We'll make sure that we get information back to you.
Okay. One last question.
Sure.
And you got to make it brief.
Sure.
They're also trying to undermine the initiative process as well, because they don't like the people passing all these things.
Absolutely.
The legislators want to be able to have a monopoly.
Absolutely.
On what gets passed in Missouri.
Absolutely.
And so that's another issue. And are there bills that are trying to reform the initiative too?
They are. They're not current bills yet, so I can't give you the numbers. There is legislation, though, where they are actively working together to write legislation to undermine our ballot initiative process here in Missouri. This is not only in Missouri. It's happening across the country. The states that still have the ballot initiative process, our legislators are trying to take away our democracy. It is very much a trying to unravel and dismantle our current democracies by taking the will of the people from the people and only giving it to our legislators.
So we should see this as a much bigger assault.
Absolutely.
On the rights of the people.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Cecilia Belzer Patton from Missouri Jobs with Justice. I'm Judy Ansel.
This is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, judge rules coal company can eliminate retiree health care. From the CasperWyomingTrib.com for February 28th and March 2nd. In a statement for miners and their families published Friday, March 1st, the United Mine Workers of America noted that the $6 million a bankruptcy judge recently instructed Westmoreland Coal to set aside for retiree health care wouldn't last the year. The union is negotiating its contract with the likely buyer of the Wyoming Kemmerer Mine, Virginia businessman Tom Clark. Westmoreland Coal Company filed for bankruptcy in October, citing the troubled coal market. Judge David Jones of the Bankruptcy Court in Houston recently granted Westmoreland the right to dispense with retiree health care liabilities. Cecil Roberts, president of UMWA, encouraged miners and their families to write their congressmen in support of bills that would guarantee benefits to miners like those from Kemmerer, including Senate Bill 27, the American Miners Act. In a related move, the bankruptcy judge for the Northern District of Alabama ruled on March 1st that the bankrupt Mission Coal Company could eliminate its union agreement and end retiree health care and pension contributions. Mission Coal Company is owned by Tom Clark, prospective buyer of the Kemmerer Mine. Next, hidden costs of stressed-out workers from the Wall Street Journal at www.wsj.com, February 28th, from the article by Jeffrey Pfeffer, Stanford Graduate School of Business. Employee health care benefits cost Starbucks more annually than coffee beans. General Motors spends more on them than on steel. But beyond the giant budget item, every company's business practices affect the physical and mental health of its employees. Over the years, businesses have reduced the risk of workplace injuries and accidents. But the harm to employees from stressful working conditions hasn't gotten nearly the same attention. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention reported in 2016 that stress is the leading workplace health problem, ahead of physical inactivity and obesity. It affects both blue and white-collar jobs across a wide range of income and is a leading contributor to turnover, absenteeism, and productivity losses. Professor Pfeffer and colleagues reviewed more than 200 studies on workplace stress in an article published in 2015. They found some stresses raise the risk of illness and morbidity more than secondhand smoke. They also developed a mathematical model to estimate the aggregate annual health effects. It attributed $190 billion in excess cost to workplace stress and 120,000 annual deaths, enough to place it sixth among causes of death in the U.S., ahead of diabetes and kidney disease. What can be done to avoid these costs to employees and employers? A number of companies have improved their employees' health and productivity by using some straightforward strategies, according to Pfeffer, summarizing the article. 1. Regular limited work hours. 2. Greater autonomy. And 3. More economic security. Finally, are Missouri cannabis cultivators ready for workplace health and safety? According to the Associated Press for March 2nd, more than 400 pre-applications from potential marijuana growers and sellers have already been filed with the state of Missouri, months before licenses will be awarded. Missouri voters approved a ballot measure last November allowing for marijuana to treat a wide range of ailments. The state is still drafting rules and regulations for how the program will be operated. One good reference for occupational health and safety is from the state of Colorado. Biological hazards in cannabis cultivation could include mold, skin sensitizers, and allergens. Chemical hazards include carbon dioxide used in greenhouses, pesticides, nutrients, cleaning chemicals, and volatile organics from the plants themselves. Physical hazards, typical of all growers, include noise, machine hazards such as trimmers, electrical cords, and much more. Every facility should have an employee dedicated to safety to protect the well-being of the staff and comply with state and federal laws. According to Roberta Smith, Occupational Health Program Manager for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, OSHA requires cannabis cultivators to perform a hazard assessment in their operation to determine what hazards exist. If there are chemicals being used, for example, or other hazards, business owners should try to eliminate hazards before implementing personal protective equipment, which should be used as a last resort if hazards cannot be removed, Smith says. For more information, go to www.colorado.gov, Department of Public Health and Environment, and Marijuana Program. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. This Saturday, March 9th, from 11 to 3, the Turkic Food and Arts Festival will take place at the Dialogue Institute, 4215 Shawnee Drive in KCK. Yum. League of Women Voters Candidate Forum, March 12th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Linwood United Church, 3151 Olive Street, Kansas City, Missouri. All Souls Forum, From There to Here, Leonard Zeskin will explain how we got to this point. It's political. Sunday, March 10th, 10 a.m., All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut. Wyandotte County, Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast. Saturday, March 16th, 8:15 for breakfast, 9 o'clock for speakers, at Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue. Speakers are David Haley and Bill Reardon. And Monday, March 18th, 6:30 to 8:30, Surge KC March Mass Meeting, Impact versus Intent, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., St. Mark Hope and Peace Lutheran Church, 3800 Troost Avenue. You can find our entire calendar, as well as our archived shows and our upcoming schedule, at our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called Teaching the Labor Movement How to Strike. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's going to be good. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI. Struggle and fight for the common man's rights. To be in the working class is good.